So we have two speakers this morning. We're on step 1, 2, and 3, and I am going to, our first speaker is Steve. I think you're from Florida, right? Come on up and let's welcome Steve.
I'm Steve, I'm an addict. Good to be here. I was on my head a lot about speaking, but it didn't turn out as a lot of people, so I should be good. You know how that goes. But I'll start a little bit about how it was before the program, how it was when I was using. I grew up pretty much on Fort Myers Beach, and as young, I played baseball a lot. I was watching them guys play baseball today, and it brought back a few memories. You know, I love baseball. But, it always started, I wanted to fit in. I got with the wrong crowd, and eventually, I was missing school, hanging out, skipping. It was either go to school or go to the beach. You know, it was a no-brainer for me. I hung out with the wrong people, did the wrong things, and just escalated. Jails, DUIs, a lot of DUIs. I had 3 DUIs. But, I want to touch on a few things. I remember I was running a crane, and the crane operator didn't show up. I was using, I can get on the crane, so I'm pouring concrete. I think I run the crane twice. And my brother's on the other end, so I'm running the crane. It's by the power lines, and I'm point and look, he said, it's okay. So he pulls it over, hits it, and I electrocute him. He falls straight down. I thought I killed him. The sparks, the flash, the noise. at that point I'm thinking, I had no, I couldn't believe I was even in the crane. So I got out, I run out to help him. The guys pull him up, carry him up, he's not even moving. And the guy was, inspector had a bag phone at that time, and he called 911. They come out, and they revived him. And I'm thinking, he goes, man, he says, my foot hurts. So what had happened, the electric went through his hand and blew his toes off. And, I'm thinking, man. And then that's where my at that time, my mom was dying of, she had cancer real bad, breast cancer, and she was in bad shape, getting ready to put her in hospice, and I was with that company at that time 4 years, and that's where, I really started using pretty heavy, just to try to lose all the feelings and everything that, everything going on in my life was unmanageable, and, I knew it, but I didn't want to feel it, So I just kept doing what I did. At that, my boss kind of said he'd let me go because, he knew I about killed my brother. He knew my mom was in hospice. And he really didn't say a whole lot. And, I went into detox. I didn't do nothing different. And I got the same things over and over again. fast forward, I was out on a bridge and I'm walking on a beam and I fall off and I hit the slope paving on the bottom of the concrete, messed my back up. Well, I thought I did. I went to the doctor. I was going to the doctor and my boss says, I got my personal physician. So I go there and, he says, what do you need? And they pretty much gave me whatever I needed. And, opiates was wide open then. I did that 10, 12 years every day. And, I'll shoot in, different things, hit my truck all the time, totaled a couple trucks. It's just the same things you hear over and over. then I'm driving, the last part of my addiction, I'm driving down through the Everglades. I got this bridge way out on the Indian Reservation on Snake Road. It's on Alligator Alley. So I'm driving out, and it's early in the morning, I'm driving and just got high, and there's this curve, and I missed the curve, catch it at the last minute, I flip the truck, and I end up in a canal, upside down, and everything's flashing, I can still remember, my life's flashing ahead of me, windows are up, I'm trying to get out, and I broke 3 or 4 ribs, I'm probably 5 miles away from anybody, so nobody even knew what happened, I'm right there. So I finally get out, I roll the window down, I get up on the bank, and I remember I left the dope inside the truck. So I dive back in and I get it. I mean, that's what we do. And, you know, I ate a bunch of pills and I walked. I walked 5 miles, went and got the loader, pulled it up, called my boss, and said there was a big animal come out in front. I had the mess, you know the stories we use. And he said, "Steve, come to the office." So he sent a truck on a low boy, and it came out, brought me a phone, and I called him, and he said, "Come to the office." I went to the office. He said, "Steve, everybody knows you're using. I know you got prescriptions, this. Sometimes I can't talk to you." And he goes, "I'm sick of it." He said, "You've been with me 16 years. You know, I've helped you 4 or 5 times. But his way of helping was like, go to detox and throw me a bunch of money, and that was the wrong thing to do. But he didn't know the disease of addiction, you know. You know, he just thought I was getting better, and he just wanted to help. He just didn't know. So anyway, he said, "I'll give you a week. If you can't get your life together in a week, you know, it's easier for me just to fire you." So, you know, I tried, set, kicked at home, and I just couldn't do it. I called detox. He said, "Steve, you were here 3 months ago. You can't get back in." So I called him. I said, "Hey, I can't get in." He says, "Well, give me the number." He called him, and he paid cash. So that was the end. You know, that's where I was at the end of the road. You know, I'm in a foreclosed house. I already gave one away on the beach. I got one in the country, and that was in foreclosure. And lost 2 marriages, you know, I was about to lose my job, so I had nothing left. So, you know, I went to detox, I sat in there, I listened, and I heard H&I for the first time, Narcotics Anonymous. And, you know, the guy's talking about a home group, he's talking about, you know, powerlessness. Actually, the two people was part of my home group later in the thing, but it was really cool just how I listened for once. You know, I've been in detoxes probably 12, 15 times. So yeah, I'm 48 years old, I'm sitting in there, and I finally hear the message, and I go up after the meeting, and the guys, you know, give me his where his home group was. I went. After I got out, happened to be the same day, it was Hope Without Dope. And you know, that's where it all started for me. And you know, I had about a month clean. I got a sponsor. I got books. I kept hearing these suggestions. And, you know, I got the books. I got a sponsor. And, you know, I said, "When do I start step work?" And he says, "When do you want to start feeling better?" So, you know, that's why I jumped right in at 30 days. You know, I was, had a group of guys. We met every week. And we went through the steps together, you know, and it was the best thing I ever did. I thought everybody did it. You know, I was new. I just figured, you know, everybody did the 12 steps right away. So me, you know, I knew my life was unmanageable many times. I could see it looking back, you know, through marriages, decision making. You know, every time I used, I used against my will. I would try to stop, but you know, the compulsion in my head, I knew I had to use. I just had to get there to get it. When I thought about it, I had to go. There was no change in my thought patterns then. You know, I was on a mission. I was going. So, you know, when I did step work, I seen all that. Surrender was like, you know, I never surrendered or anything. I tried to quit on my own on, you know. You know, my dad was military. He'd say, "Why can't you just quit that shit, you know?" And, it, you know, that's the way it is. And I wish I could. I tried to many times. But I couldn't. I was, you know, my life was unmanageable. I was powerless over the disease of addiction. And I just couldn't stop. I could stop for a minute. I just couldn't stay stopped, you know. You know, for me, it's just, you know, I can look back at everything in my life and know I could have made better decisions. At some points, you know, my parents helped me. They get me a house. They tried to put me in the right direction. It's just I wasn't, my thoughts were gone. You know, I tried other fellowships, but I didn't fit in there. You know, step two, my life was you know, for me, you know, I try different things. So, you know, I would try combinations of drugs. You know, I just tried about everything. And nothing worked for me. I tried smoking weed. I tried drinking. I tried everything. So, you know, I don't know. The best thing for me, I want to read this thing I like. For many of us, you know, it's in step two, you know, we a power greater than ourselves. But for many of us, the willingness to try something new came about simply because we were so tired of our old ways. It seemed to us that because of our power wasn't sufficient to restore our sanity. Perhaps something else could, if we let it. And it was easy. You know, step two for me was the hope shot. I could see, you know, I came to believe in other people would come in after me and their life was better. I couldn't see it in myself. But the more I kept coming, you know, the more I felt better and the decision making was better. You know, the how of the program, honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness, you know. I just had to get honest with myself in step one. That was the biggest thing, because I lied so much to myself. I would tell myself lies and believe everything I said. You know, and step two was like being open-minded, that there, you know, a power greater than me can help restore me to sanity. Could, you know, my sponsor used to say, if I let him. So I had no problem going through the steps the first time. You know, it was the drugs I knew was killing me. Like it says in the basic text, insanity, you know, is asking for a heart attack, when, you know, and crazy things. Would that be insane? It was. But, you know, being restored to sanity is a lifelong process for me. You know, sometimes I make bad decisions today. Somebody was sharing in a meeting last night about it. You know, I was in a relationship with a girl for a while early in recovery, and it was hard. I knew something was going on with her. She had 6-7 years clean. I knew something was up. But I just kept, you know, kind of leaving it alone, you know, and figured, oh, she'll be okay, she'll be okay. And it just, I didn't realize how bad it bothered me, and I just kept pushing along, staying in that comfort zone, knowing it's insane to be there, knowing something's different, she's probably used, something's up. And I just finally, you know, that, you know, just I had to get out of it. And it didn't turn out good, but, you know, that's her story. And, you know, for me, it affected my life a lot. I tried a lot to help her, but, you know, and then over and over and over, even the things she did that affected my life, you know, I still tried to help her, which I don't know if that's insane, but or just people pleasing or whatever you want to call it, but I did it anyway. But I don't know, I was supposed to speak on that, why they don't stay, but they changed the topic, which is fine, you know. And but anyway, we got plenty of time here. Okay, so we got step three. This is one of my favorite steps. I use this a lot. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. I used to have a sponsee that would say all the time, you know, he did step one, he did step two, he did step three, and then he did step four, he did step three, he did step five. And that kind of made it hit home. He heard that at a convention, and he told me that. I said, man, that's a great thing. So I try to practice that too, you know. When you make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him, when I got here, I tried to use somebody else's higher power, because I really ain't really into God, because I figured all the things that happened in my life, God did to me. I didn't realize, you know, God was always there, and I just made bad decisions. Today it's a lot easier. It's just I make better decisions by, you know, by just surrendering a lot. It's a deeper surrender in step three for me. A lot of times, like when traffic's bad, you know, I have to just surrender. And the easiest way for me is to call somebody, listen to music, because if I get it, you know, and I'm focused on, oh man, he just cut me off. And as soon as I say it today, I understand it. But early recovery, I'm all upset, you know, hitting the thing and yelling, waving out the window and being a real jerk. But, you know, I like, you know what it says in the Work Sound Why? It says, we begin to see positive results from our decisions, decisions we have made. We begin to notice changes while the circumstances of our lives may not change. The way we deal with these circumstances does. And that makes a lot of, I can relate a lot to that. Because I used to make some terrible decisions. I think we all, you know, knew. And the more I make decisions, it's a lot easier. At work, it's a big thing. You know, I used to go out on the job and say, oh, do this, do that, do this. The guys know what to do. You know, most of them have been with me 20 years, and they're all good. And I don't need to control everything. I need to make sure they're doing their job, everything's set up, and just kind of surrender. And I've learned that. It took me a while. And sometimes I'm not real good at it. But most days, you know, I can tell them in the morning, you need anything, whatever, and I have, you know, faith that they got this in the care of, you know, it makes it easier when I just surrender there. And if something's wrong or unsafe, then I can say something, but I just got to get out of the way a lot. You know, and this is like, let's see what we got. Recovery doesn't exempt us from having to live through painful situations. At some point in our lives, we may have to mourn the death of a loved one or deal with the end of a relationship. And I touched a little bit about that, the end of that relationship, and it was the best thing I ever did. And mourn loved ones, you know, I had a few sponsees that, you know, that passed away, and that was really hard. You know, one guy I sponsored 3 years, one guy I sponsored about 5 years, and to watch him, you know, to die, it was hard, and but I had the fellowship with me. I didn't have to do it alone. It's great. You know, it's a good thing to have more people to help me. It was just a powerful thing. I remember having 2 years clean, and my nephew said, Uncle Steve, he says, how'd you get clean? I said, these meetings. I said, I'll pick you up, Eli. He says, all right. So I picked him up. He says, man, I can't quit shooting dope. He says, I'm bad. I don't know what to do. I said, let's go to the meeting. So I went to the meeting. It was a Friday night. And I didn't tell him. I was speaking that night. And it was good. And after the meeting, he came up and he says, what is a halfway house? And I said, well, you know, if you need a, you know, you need to, he says, well, I need to go to detox. So he went to detox. I got him in a halfway house, helped him. He had, he was about a week out, and my brother called me. He says, hey, I can't get a hold of him. I said, he's all right. So I called the halfway house, and they said he left with some girl. So I'm thinking, yeah, you know, he's just going out. He's having fun. So I called him, and then my brother called me the next day, and he said they found him dead in a pond, overdosed, 23 years old. So, you know, that was hard for me, too. I thought I could have did something different. I could have helped him more. I should have been over there. All these thoughts I had in my head. You know, I know today I'm powerless over that. I did what I could do. And again, NA calls me, people I haven't heard from, you know, my phone blows up. And, you know, I didn't have to go through it alone. I had to share it at meetings. And it's crazy to, once I went to the funeral, everybody's using music, and you know, everybody wanted to go with me. I said, I'm good. They said, if you need me, call me. My sponsor was like right down the street, I wanted to speak, but it was just, I couldn't do it. It was just too much for me at that time. You know, maybe today, or
And I've said a prayer, and I've did a lot of things since then, because, you know, it really affects me mentally about that. But, you know, today, the how of the program, what I do is, you know, I get up in the morning, read it just for today, make a few phone calls, a few people call me, and listen to music. It's like a big thing for me. I like to listen to music to lose my mind, work out. That's a new thing, you know, after the relationship, that's what I use. I kind of jumped into the gym. First it was stress, losing weight, you're not eating. Okay, I think everybody can relate to that. And then it jumped into going to the gym. And then it jumped into getting a trainer. You know, my sponsor kind of, you know, he says you need somebody mentally, spiritually, and physically. So I got a trainer. And, you know, I was kind of, I did it out of town, like probably, because I was kind of didn't want to do it in my town. I don't know why, I'm all in my head about that. You know, somebody see me in there with a trainer, but it was the best thing I did, you know. And I built this relationship with this guy. And he's not in the program, but it's good to build relationships, you know, outside. And even with my boss, you know, I was like the worst employee, and now I'm kind of doing, I go to meetings in his behalf, you know, it's pretty cool. And I, he's 84 now, he's, I think, still in the hospital, he goes back and forth, and I make sure everything's good, you know, the company's good, different jobs are good, and it's just a whole, you know, turnaround for me. And I couldn't have did it without Narcotics Anonymous and you guys and asking questions. You know, I went through the steps 2 years ago with my sponsor, and our goal was, he goes, what goal do you want? Because each time we go through, you know, I got to make an amends for myself of a goal. So the goal was, maybe I'll get my general contractor's license. And, you know, I didn't know if I needed it or what, but I did that. And it took me a while because I got eighth grade education. So I dropped out in eighth grade, so I got GED. Went to school, went to the Camtech thing, and I got it. So, you know, that's just another thing. I think you can do whatever you want in here. You get out of it what you put into it, is what I keep hearing. And, you know, stay in the middle of the boat, you can't fall out. It's one of my favorite sayings because that's what I heard when I got here. And that's what I did. You know, I jumped right in the middle, service, my whole recovery. H&I, that's where I heard the message, that's where I stay. But, yeah, you know, Narcotics Anonymous saved my life. I don't know if I said a whole lot about steps 1, 2, and 3, but I try to live them steps, you know, every day. And that's all I got. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve. I just haven't known Steve very long. I met him a couple years ago, friends on Facebook, but it's always nice to hear somebody's story. Everybody's got a story in here, you know. Thanks for sharing. So our next speaker is Leah, and I've known her for a while. I love her to death, and come on up.
My name's Leah. It's good to be here. I figured first thing in the morning there wouldn't be a lot of people, so that's the only good thing, because I have like brain fog. It generally takes me till about noon to be functional. You know, I think back on my using and what it was like, and it's a miracle that I ever made it here. I came to Narcotics, I mean, I started using when I was like about 13. And my first OD, I was 15 years old. And I mean, I almost didn't make it. I was unconscious for 3 days. The last thing, I left home then. My brothers saw me wheeled out on a stretcher to go to the hospital. I never came home. And, you know, it was rough. My using came early, it came hard, and You know, and I never ever felt like I actually even belonged in this world. So it's not surprising that I was looking for any out. And so I started using. I was living in L.A. My parents had gotten divorced, and we moved to L.A. And so I was using, and it was the 70s. It was a you know, not quite like the 60s, but it was sort of crazy. And I think back on all the things I did that, you know, I used to sit around and just hitchhike all over. I mean, everybody hitchhiked all over the place. And nowadays you look and you're like, you never see a hitchhiker on the side of the road with their thumb out. You know, but we would just hitchhike all over the place. And I was using the hard, and I, you know, started, you know, just smoking a little pot and wind up, you know, using a lot of other things. And, you know, so I did this OD and I came back. My father came out and took me away from my mother because, you know, she wanted to commit me to it. I didn't have treatment back then. It was a mental hospital. And they said I would probably need a year of treatment. So my father came and got me. And I came back to D.C. And, you know, I just continued using because that's what I did. And, you know, and I was out on my own by the time I was 17. And the using continued to progress and progress. And, you know, I did a lot of things. And I remember at one point I was on a methadone clinic in the early 80s, and I wanted to get off of methadone. I was like, methadone is the problem. And so I was always substituting one for another. When I came to Narcotics Anonymous, I had no qualms about, you know, when they talked about substituting one for another, and I had, you hear people come into the rooms and talk about, I don't know if I'm an addict, I don't know about this. I had no question. That is where I had no problem, is when I walked into Narcotics Anonymous, knowing that my whole life, I was 26 years old, so I'd been using for 13 years at that point, that I had always substituted one for another, and that, you know, I was going to get it together, I was going to get off methadone and quit shooting dope, but then my drinking got so bad that I'd wake up shaking in the morning, needing a drink, and I'd be like, well, I'm going to wake up sick in the morning, I want to do something I prefer, you know, and I'd go back to this or that, and I was, so substituting one for another was something I completely understood. I didn't understand that, you know, I could actually stop using and find a new way of life, which is what I found here. But, you know, the end was so bad for me that I had managed to sort of pull it together for a while, and I was sinking back into the deep, dark hole of addiction. And not that I was ever out of it, but the semblance, you know, that, you know, I had an apartment. When I was doing one thing, I could manage things better than when I was doing other things. And so I could just see this big black hole. And I was, you know, here it is, you know, I was probably on methadone in, I don't know, a number of years at different times. But I remember when NA first came to Washington, D.C., or not when it first came, but when I was first introduced to it, and there was a meeting apparently at my methadone clinic, and I was trying to get off this methadone. And this counselor I had was like, you should go to this meeting we have here on Thursday nights. And I was like, I don't know what meeting it is. I'm not going to it. I don't need any help. I can manage this on my own because that's what I did, right? I managed everything so well. And, you know, and so I wound up getting off the one thing. But I didn't stop using because I was substituting one for another because that was my whole life. And, you know, I could just pull it together if I did this or that. And it didn't really work for me, surprisingly enough. And I was sinking into this deep, dark hole. And so finally, I was 26 years old. It was 1986. And I saw one of these PSAs on TV. I think it was the guy in the tennis shoes in the phone booth. You know, it was raining. And it said to call this number. So I called this number. And I really wasn't ready to surrender. I didn't know what was going on. And this guy answered the phone, and he saved my life. And he's still clean today. He was like carrying around a beeper, so you know they would beep him, and then they would call you back and stuff like that. And I guess he pulled over on the side of the road and called me back from a phone booth and talked me into going to a meeting. You know, and that was the beginning of the end for me. It was not the end, but it was the very beginning of the end. And the end didn't take long. You know, it was really surprising to me that I could continue doing all that using for those 13 years, which at the time was half my life. And he got me to start coming to meetings, and it was a good group. It was a solid group. NA was in a tremendous growth spurt at the time, which, of course, I didn't know anything because I was clueless. But, you know, the book had been out, you know, a couple years. And, I mean, I bought my first basic text from this guy's trunk because groups couldn't afford to even have books, you know. And so he would buy them and sell them out of his trunk. And anyway, so he got me to come to meetings, and he would say things like, you know, you can get clean, just don't pick up. And I was like, what the fuck is this guy talking about? Don't pick up. It's a foreign concept to me. Don't pick up. I don't know how not to pick up. You know, that's all I did every day, you know, for years. And a lot of things happened. I mean, there were a lot of things to demonstrate certainly my unmanageability. I didn't understand powerlessness, but, you know, I met this guy. We got married. We had a couple kids. You know, and they took the kids away from us and put, you know, and he got locked up, and I, you know, the kids are in foster care, and I'm like, what am I going to do now? Well, I'm going to continue to fucking use because I am a victim. You know, these people are picking on me, and why are they bothering me, and all this kind of stuff. And I worked in clubs, and, you know, I made a lot of money, but I never had any money because I needed to use every day, all day. And what I used was expensive. And, you know, so I had these kids, and they were taken away and put in foster care, and so we would go, we'd have visits with them, and of course I was still using, and, you know, and I could never get it together. I could never pass urine tests. I could never, you know, it was always like, I'm this victim. And so, you know, there were a lot of things to show me how unmanageable my life was and how the disease ran my life and how I couldn't manage anything, yet, you know, I never really believed that there was anything I could do about it. And so I finally called this phone line, and he got me to come to a meeting, and he even forgot he told me. I guess he answered all the phone calls, so he was always trying to get addicts to a meeting because we didn't have a lot of meetings, and, you know, the more people we could get in, the more maybe we could, you know, establish a fellowship. And I was able to come to meetings for a while, and I would come to meetings, but I was still using, and he would say things like, you know, NA is about total abstinence, and I'd say, oh, I'm doing so much better, I'm using less, you know, I'm trying to detox. I worked in clubs. I'd be like, I can't not go to work, you know, like it was fucking important, right? The only reason I needed to go to work was so I could continue using. And so eventually I came to a point where I would go out, even on Monday nights, I would go out and fellowship. They did this pizza recovery after this step and tradition meeting on Monday nights. And it was every week, and people would go, and you just kick in a few bucks. And it was a great time, and it was a big group. I mean, probably 20 people out of the 30 in the meeting would go. And, you know, and I was a very angry and hostile person. I am not a touchy-feely person now. I am very sort of cut and dry, suck it up, get on with it kind of person. And this is with, you know, many years clean, and at the time I was a very hostile person is the kindest way to say it. And, you know, and I would sort of sit there at this thing, and I'd have my arms crossed, and I'd be angry. And, of course, you know, I was still using. And I, you know, so I wasn't getting the fellowshipping and the happy, joyous, and free, or, you know, a new way of life, or any of these concepts that, you know, people who are clean can sort of grasp, even in the beginning, if it's only for a few minutes, you know, that gives you the hope to continue on. And so but I did this, and I was doing this every week, and I was going to meetings, you know, 2 or 3 days a week. The day at nights I wasn't working, and I was using less, and so I wasn't like really high, but I wasn't like willing to detox or go through any pain. And you know, and then finally, after, you know, several months of doing this, I was living with this guy, and, you know, and he drank, but he couldn't understand, you know, that my using was the same as his using, except that his was legal, and he had a good job. And and finally I came home one day, and I was like, look, I need to go to my mom's to detox because I need to get out of here. And so he bought me a plane ticket. He's like, go detox, that's fine. And I went to my mom's, and because I had that inkling of going to some meetings here, I went to some meetings out there. And she knew what meetings were a little bit, only because her brother, my uncle, had gotten a couple DWIs and was at court ordered, like court slip things. So he took me to a couple meetings out there, and you know, and he got it, and he was like an old Navy guy, and, you know, a drunk, and he was like, you know, I would have used stuff, if I was, you know, growing up today, I would have used stuff. He understood, you know, that the drinking was just the same, but, you know, drinking was his era. And anyway, I managed to get clean, and she wanted me to stay out there, and I hated L.A., and I was like, I'm not staying here. But after about a month, I came back. And it was August of 1986. And I still had not bought in to like a new way of life. I could do this just for today, for the rest of my life. This was still just sort of like, I'm going to get a little better, and then I'm going to pull it together, and then I'm going to go on with my fabulous life, right? And so I came back, and in August of 1986. And I came back to this guy, and, you know, I think I came back on a Sunday night, and I went to a meeting on Monday night, and it was the same pizza recovery meeting that I first started going to, and I told every, you know, and then when Chris Kay is the guy who answered the phone for me, and he's like, you know, how are you doing? I was like, oh, I'm clean now. And I was actually clean for the first time, and God knows, you know, I don't know how long, it had to be a long time. You know, and I'd gone through a lot through that, and, you know, my kids were in foster care, and they were actually taken away from me and put up for adoption. You know, the husband got out of jail, but, you know, we were done. He was really just my dope buddy. And, you know, so I was at the end of this road, and I came back, and I went to a meeting Monday night, and I wasn't working, and then I came, and I went to a Monday meeting on Tuesday night. And then I woke up on Wednesday morning, and the obsessive thought came into my head that I had to use. I had no choice but to use. And in my life, I had never, ever, you know, not used when it was sort of like that obsession hit you, and it's like, I got to get some money, I got to get some dope, I got to try and get it in me, I got to do whatever, you know, whatever it fucking takes to get high. And it hit me, and it was bad. And so I'd been back in town, you know, less than 72 hours, and I was ready to go cop. And this little teeny voice in my head said, go to a meeting first, then you can cop. And, you know, and I did something different. I actually listened to that little voice. That, and so it was morning, and, you know, I didn't drive or anything, and I got a cab, and I went to this meeting. There was this clubhouse that actually had noon NA meetings in it in Northern Virginia called the Alano Club. And so, you know, I had looked at the list. I'd never been there. I didn't know anybody there, and I just went to this meeting. And there were 10 people in the meeting, and I sat there with my arms crossed, because all I was doing was waiting for the meeting to end, because that was my deal to go fucking use. Once I gave it a shot, then I could go use, because I listened to that little voice, and it said, go to a meeting first. So I went to a meeting first, and I went to this meeting, and I was just sitting there with my arms crossed, hostile. I couldn't wait for that hour to be up. And, you know, and this guy was leading the meeting, and he called on me, and I was like, you know, I just said my name, and I was like, you know, and I didn't say anything. I didn't even say that I wanted to go use, because I didn't want anybody to talk me out of it. And, you know, and after the meeting, he came up to me, and I don't know who this guy is. I don't know his name. And he was like, hey, look, I don't know what you're doing the rest of the day, but I have a friend in Arlington Hospital that I need to go visit. And then why don't I take you to lunch? You come with me, and then I'll take you to lunch. You know, and I was ready to go cop, and I don't know what it was. It was like, you know, divine intervention, God's will, you know, desperation. I don't know what it was, but I said, okay. You know, and I went with this guy, and we had went and saw this guy. I don't know who we were going to visit at a hospital. I can't remember who that was. And we went to lunch, and it was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and he was like, okay, I'll drop you back at your place now. And he's like, "Are you okay?" And I was like, and it had been lifted. That obsession to use had been lifted. And it was the first time in my life that it wasn't immediately followed by the compulsive action. And it was like the first time I realized that if I don't give into it, if I don't follow it, if I ask for help, if I'm willing, it will go away. I never knew that feeling of like, I have to use, and I have to use now, and I have to use whatever I can get, and I have to use as hard as I can right this fucking minute, would go away. How can it go away? You know? And it was only like 3.5 hours maybe, you know? And it was gone. And once, I mean, that was like a complete turning point for me, because I was able to realize that if I could just hold on for that minute, hold on for that 5 minutes, hold on for that hour, that it would go away. See, because I never knew that concept. I never knew that if I didn't give in, if I didn't do it, that it would go away. How does it go away? It was, you know, it was just like opened my whole world up, because, you know, I knew that then, if I just held on, if I just held on. So it wasn't like it was smooth sailing, but it was like an incredible relief to know that if I could just call somebody, if I could just get to that meeting, you know, if I could just hold on for that little bit of time, you know, because I knew I was powerless. There was no doubt about it that, you know, I was not doing that. There was no way I was doing that. My using was substituting one for another. And, you know, my life was still unmanageable. Everything was a mess. I had, if it was probably September, I might have had 30 days clean, 35 days clean. And, I mean, there was not a lot of treatment back then. And if you didn't have insurance, you weren't getting into the few treatment center beds. And I didn't want to go to treatment anyway because, you know, I didn't think they could help me. And, you know, life was completely unmanageable. Everything was unmanageable about my life. I was living with this guy, and he wanted to drink, and, you know, he didn't understand that, oh, just because if I stopped doing this, I had to stop that, and it didn't last for very long, but I did go back, and I went back to work in a club, but I was like, I decided I could work the day shift, because I didn't need to make a ton of money, you know, I could make a few $100 a week instead of needing to make a lot of money to use, and I had more money making less. What a concept, you know, and, I was still angry. I didn't really feel like this was going to be the way of life for me, but I will tell you, a really big turning point in my recovery was, so I came back here, and it was September of 1986, and the World Convention was, I think they were just going, or they had just come back. A bunch of people in my home group had just come back from London, and there wasn't really much fellowship outside of the U.S. And you know, we probably had 8 people who went over there, and they came back so hyped up over this whole idea of like there are other people there, and they're like not just here, and all this, and they were just so hyped up, and I was like, well, I'm going to go to the next convention. I don't know what this convention business is, but I'm going to go to the next convention and see what this is all about. And it was in Norfolk, Virginia. It was January. It was 1987. The fellowship was really, had been, you know, I didn't know anything about the fellowship or what was going on anywhere, but I found all this out later, but the fellowship was growing at such a tremendous pace, and conventions were popping up here, there, and everywhere, and they were getting bigger, and so I went to this convention. It was Norfolk. It was January. It's not like, you know, the nicest time to go anywhere, and, you know, it's cold, it's yucky, and I went, and it completely changed my life. You know, completely changed my life, because for the first time I was out of my little group of like 30 or 40 people that I would see, and we didn't have a ton of meetings, but, you know, we had meetings every night of the week. We had, you know, we probably had 20 meetings in D.C., maybe 25 in the city, and not many in the suburbs. So I went to this convention, and it completely changed my life. I sat in marathon meetings in the middle of the night, and I would watch like there'd be like a guy from the military, and he'd be there crying, or some farmer dude, and there was like a biker dude, and it was like this whole hodgepodge of different types of people all in one place talking about their feelings and not wanting to use and not knowing what to do. And, you know, 7-8 years was like a lot of time. If somebody had, you know, even a couple of years, they were like, had a lot of time. The guy who answered my phone when I called, you know, had 3 years clean, and or 2.5, and I, you know, so clean time was a whole different thing then, and so I could relate to them. It wasn't like so far out there. A lot of times today, I feel like newcomers don't relate to somebody who's been clean a long time because they just don't think I've ever been where they were, and I clearly remember what it was like, you know. And so, you know, and my active using, I wanted to fix everything when I came back. I want to get to some of the unmanageability, you know, and a lot of the unmanageability, you know, it's the, when you get clean, you know, the exterior unmanageability, you know, I can say, oh, you know, I'm living with this guy, you know, I don't have anything in my name, I'm, you know, I had my children removed and actually put up for adoption, so, you know, I lost my children, you know, all this unmanageability, it's very evident, it's sort of, you know, you see the physical aspects of it, you know, and then as you try and get clean, you realize that a lot of the unmanageability is an internal kind of thing. It's like, you know, that I can't manage my feelings, I don't know how to live, you know, and that all these things are sort of internal, even if you can pull the external together. And sometimes that's, the external is generally the easier part. You know, you can get a job, you're not using, so you can get a few dollars, you can, you know, maybe get a place to live and pay rent, things like that, you know, the external. The internal unmanageability is just, you know, emotional and understanding, you know, that you need help for this. And it took me a long time to understand that because, you know, I could pull it together. I'm good with the managing things, you know, the physical aspects of managing life. Once I stopped using, I was able to figure out, like, okay, this is how I do it. I get an apartment, I save a few dollars, I get an apartment, I try and do this, you know, a lot of different things. But the unmanageability inside took a long time, you know, and the concept of a higher power, you know, my mom had been raised a strict Catholic, and then when she got divorced, like, and my father was this atheist, and so she didn't go to church when she was married, and then when she was divorced, she didn't want to go to church because they wouldn't recognize the divorce because she was Catholic. So, you know, we were never raised with any type of religion or going to church or anything like that. I had no concept of a God or a higher power, you know, and so it wasn't like I had anything to draw on. I do feel like some people come in here with some semblance of faith. Sometimes it's not necessarily a positive thing, but they have something to draw on and something to work with. But I came here and I just thought people were, you know, what the hell are they talking about? You know, this other being or whatever it is. And I'm being in D.C., there's a lot of, you know, God and sort of church influence. And I don't understand that, but I tried to, like, let that go. And so, you know, I understood the powerlessness and that, you know, I have no control over my disease and substituting one for another. And I tell you that, you know, there are some people who helped me in my early recovery, and they don't know how much they helped me. And a bunch of them are still clean. I mean, it's incredible how many people who got clean at that time, and I don't know if it's because we were so desperate and there weren't many outs and there weren't treatment centers and everybody sort of felt like, you know, this is my last shot. I got nowhere else to go. It wasn't quite the it didn't seem like it was quite the revolving door. I mean, people would get clean and it seemed like more of them stayed clean the first time when they came in, but maybe it wasn't, you know, maybe they had tried everything else. I don't know. I know it was a hard time because, you know, our fellowship in D.C. was really devastated with HIV and AIDS, and people would get clean, you know, they'd get 15 months clean, they'd get a diagnosis, and they were dead 6 months later. There was nothing they could do for anything, and it was, you know, it was a hard thing, but it was also a visible, like, you know, if I go out there and use, that's, you know, that's going to be me kind of thing. So, anyway, so, you know, when I come to the sort of the second step and coming to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, that was such a hard concept for me. First, I don't ever remember sanity. I never, you know, not internal sanity. There was always a lot of internal turmoil to me. And I don't know if it's because my parents got divorced and my mom moved us away. I don't know what caused it. I don't really care. I don't think it really matters, you know, why I feel certain ways. It's just, you know, what do I do about it? That's the solution. Because, I mean, when my father came and got me after I OD'd, he put me in a, I lived with him for a few months and my behavior was so out of control, you know, that he saw what my mother saw, and then he put me in a nut house and, you know, adolescent psychiatric facility, and I went through so much therapy, and I was like in an inpatient place, and then it was outpatient, and, you know, he had money, so there was a school there, and I could go every day, and he actually let me drink at home. He was like, you know, it was fine. They didn't really have the concept of like my acting out and my crazy behavior might, you know, be helped by not using, you know. And so I was in all this therapy, and I mean a lot, for about a year, and I understood sort of a lot of why I did what I did, but what I had was no solution on how to change my behavior. You know, and I'm a good addict. There was like all these different little levels, and if you did this, you got like a lot more freedom as time went on, and I could play the game. And so it was like a 9-month program, and I was out in 3. And then I just went, back to the races. And at 17, I left home. You know, my dad let me, and you know, and I went to work in these clubs, and you know, the using got worse, the babies came, all this stuff. So, but I could pull it together. And so I had all this stuff, and so I came to NA, and I understood, you know, oh, I do this because I feel this way, or I feel that way, or this or that. But what I had was no way to change what I was doing, no way to get better. And so the steps helped me, but when it came to coming to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, that was this foreign concept. And I finally, when I was working with my sponsor and writing about it and all that stuff, restored me to what kind of sanity? I don't remember any sanity in my life. And so she was like, look, why don't we just talk about it, remove some of the insanity. A power greater than yourself can help you remove some of this insanity from your life. You know, and that was something I could sort of wrap my brain around. That, you know, I couldn't be restored to something I didn't remember, but some of the insanity that I felt could be removed. And that worked for me. That helped me a lot and allowed me to, like, go on and sort of get a concept of a higher power and sort of believe that, you know, if I just did this and I believed in this, and it really, really was the people. It was that guy who answered the phone line. It was this girl that he made me call, because I called the phone line and he would talk to me and he got me good meetings and he did all this, and he'd say, call me every day or I'm going to think you've OD'd in an alley, because he knew that I was still using it. How are you doing? I'm doing better. I'm using less. So he would say, I think you're going to be dead in an alley OD'd if you don't call me every night. And I would call him, and I worked in clubs, and I would call him at 2 in the morning, and he would say, and I need you to call Susie. I need you to call Susie because you need to talk to girls. And Susie had a real job. Chris didn't work. He was like in college. His parents were paying for him to go to art school or some Corcoran School of Art. And so, you know, he could be up at all hours of the night. But Susie would answer the phone for me too. And so I started doing this. And even though I was using, they were taking my calls. You know, and that let me believe that they cared about me. And it was so important. It was so, so important to me. And so these people were really, you know, that concept of a power greater than myself, because I still couldn't believe in a God, you know, or a higher power. But these people, they were there and they were helping me. And, you know, they used to say, oh, you know, you can pray to a doorknob. Well, I wasn't going to pray to a doorknob. And I wasn't going to pray to these people. But I could believe that they were a power greater than myself. For one thing, he answered that call and got me to go to a meeting. And I don't know how he did that. And I can't imagine the level of desperation for me to make that call or to actually follow through on showing up at the meeting after, you know, I made the call. And so that helped me a lot with, you know, that power greater than myself. And then, you know, God's will for me, you know, I didn't really understand you know, turning my life over to the care of a higher power. What the fuck does that mean? You know, what is a higher power? There's just nothing for me there. And that God and the whole concept of that, you know, but I, now that I've, you know, I've been clean a while and just looking at all the evidence I've seen of a power sort of stepping in and what we do for each other when we're in trouble, you know, and how many times have I been to a meeting, you know, where somebody is showing pain and the fellowship just goes and sort of picks them up and carries them along. That is a power. That is a tremendous power. That is like God's will, whatever God is, and I still don't know, and I don't need to. That's the beauty of it. It's like I don't have dogma, and I don't have to believe that certain thing. You know, I can see the evidence when, you know, somebody in here loses a family member, and the next thing you know, there's 30 people at their house. What do you need? How can we help you? You know, cry on my shoulder. Let me take you to a meeting. Let's bring a meeting to you. And, you know, all of that is a power greater than myself. Because, you know, alone, if I see a friend in pain, I'm going to want to run. You know, I don't like being in an uncomfortable position. I don't not like not being able to fix something. I don't like just being able to sit there and be with somebody who's in pain and allow them to go through that pain, you know. But a power greater than myself, you know, will allow me to just sort of sit there. I mean, one of my best friends lost a husband who was like my best friend in the world and helped me in my first, I don't know, 10, 12 years. We would spend every weekend together, and my husband and I and this couple, and when he got sick and died clean, it was just like, you know, it was probably my first big incredible thing, but I didn't, you know, and I felt the loss tremendously, and she would just call me at 1 a.m. and I would get in my bathrobe and drive to her house, and we would sleep on the couches in her living room just so she didn't have to be alone. You know, and that was not me doing that. That was a power greater than myself allowing me to be of service and be there for someone. You know, fast forward another 10 years and her son's out of treatment, gets a year clean. We go visit him in Philadelphia for his first anniversary on a cold, wet, rainy night, actually like in January. Do you want to go? And I had like raised this kid. I'd been there when he, you know, he was born. When she was overseas and he got busted, I went and got him out of jail. I brought him to my house for a few months. I took him to a convention. I mean, he was just like, you know, he was like a son to me. And I didn't want to go with her. She wanted to go to Eli's first anniversary. I was like, no, not really. And a power greater than myself said, what do you have to lose? You don't have anything else you have to do. Just go. And I went. And, you know, we drove up to Philadelphia. We went to dinner with a bunch of his friends. And then we went to this meeting. And he had a year clean. He had he was 21 years old that week. And it was in December. And 3 weeks later, he got run over by a truck and died. And so I was there for her husband, I was there for her son. And for me to be able to do that, that's a power greater than myself, because that is not me. First off, I didn't have 20-year friendships when I was using. You know, 20 minutes was a long time, 20 days, dope buddies, you know. And then if I had more than you, then I want nothing else to do with you. And if... anyway, it was, you know, and so now here I've established these friendships, and that's a power greater than myself working through me so I could be there for somebody else. And I've seen that with myself, and, you know, and all this evidence that I've got and what I see in fellowship, I really do believe that the fellowship is a power greater than myself. I still don't really have an individual God. I'm not, you know, I haven't embraced any particular religion. I don't have all of this, and I don't have to. That's the great thing about Narcotics Anonymous. I'm able to come here and turn my will and my life over, and, you know, and I sort of feel like I'm one of the lucky ones, because I came in at Narcotics Anonymous. It took me a few months to get clean. I got clean. I was able to have the obsession to use lifted in one day, that one bad day. Once I realized that I could stop using, that the feeling would go away, it was lifted from me. And it wasn't, and I see people do that or get it together and then, you know, disappear, get a few years clean, life gets good, and they disappear. And I feel like I'm so lucky that I was able to come in here, get clean, stay clean, find a fellowship, find a family, because I'm not close to my family. I've lost so many people who I feel like are my family within the fellowship, but I never really got close to my family. I guess I left when I was young, but it wasn't like we had a bad relationship. I just wasn't close. I left home on a stretcher and had very little to do with my brothers when they were little. So even though, you know, we're okay together, I may never see them again now that our parents are gone. But we spent quite a bit when my mother was sick, and the last 2 or 3 months we were all at her house, and it was, you know, it was actually sort of nice to spend a little time with them. But my family is here. You know, you guys are my higher power, yet I have not felt it necessary to put anybody on a pedestal, because individually we're all fallible. There is no single person in here is like my higher power, or I look at you and you're the, you know, I pin everybody, but collectively we are a power that is incredible, and I still can't believe that I have it in my life, and that I've managed to get clean, stay clean, continue on. And you know, service has been a big part of it, because I'm a firm believer that I can't get if I don't give, and that I get so much more for every little bit that I give. And you know, so I got involved early and I stayed involved, and I've done so many things here, and I've learned so much, you know, and even just the life skills, because I had no skills. I dropped out of high school, you know, but I was able to come in here. I learned how to like sit in a business meeting, which allowed me to like go to a work meeting. I swear to God though, every time I'm in a non-NA meeting, like with normal people, I always like, don't say you're an addict first, because I always want to, I'm sitting, you know, and be careful, don't say, you know, when you announce yourself, don't say who you are, but what you are. But you know, I really find it a miracle that I was able to come in here, get clean, understand that I was powerless over my addiction, my life was unmanageable, that, you know, I could believe that some of the insanity could be removed from my life, and I was able to find, you know, a God of my understanding, and that that helps carry me through every day, and that I don't have to use, and that over all these years I've been able to come in here and never like waver, never believe that I had it together. I know where the power comes from, and then the power is the fellowship, and that without you, you know, my best thinking would have me thinking that, oh, I could have a cocktail with people after work, or, you know, what's the big deal? It's been decades. I can, you know, all of this, I can manage it, but because of you, I know I can, and there's enough people here that do the research for me that I see over and over again, so, you know, and that's important to me. So I still need that, because I cannot believe that I ever have it together. Anyway, you know, I'm not a morning person. I get this brain fog. Noon is about generally when my day starts, so I think that's enough out of me. So thanks for listening. Thanks for letting me share.
I'm Jeff, I'm an addict. Let's see here. I want to thank Leah and Steve for sharing. And I want to thank everybody that got up early to come to this workshop. Yeah. And so we're going to close with a serenity prayer.
What about
redo the color? Oh, yeah, let's redo the color.
Spiritual, non-religious program known as Narcotics Anonymous.
Thank you, Barry. All right, can we have a moment of silence? Serenity prayer. God, grant us serenity to accept the things we cannot change, courage to change the things we can.